Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Mary Beth Shannon. I'm the director of the Market and Policy Monitor Program at the California Healthcare Foundation. And find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org and the foundation at chcf.org. This program's underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation in association with the Commonwealth Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Shannon Brownlee. Shannon's the acting director of the New America Foundation's Health Policy Program. She's a nationally known writer and essayist, and Shannon's works appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times Sunday Magazine, The New Republic, Slate Times, and many other prominent publications. She's the author of the book, Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer, which was named the best economics book of 2007 by The New York Times. In addition to her work with the New America Foundation, Shannon is also an instructor at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. She's won numerous writing awards and was recently named one of the 45 most influential graduates of UC Santa Cruz on the 45th anniversary of the founding of the campus. I'd also like to introduce our moderator, Carolyn Johnson. Carolyn co-anchors ABC 7 News at 4, 6, and 11 p.m. weekdays and also reports on health and science issues. She won a regional Edward R. Murrow Award from the Radio and Television News Directors Association for Best Newscast and won an Emmy in 2009 for Best Evening Newscast, among other awards and honors. She's a graduate of Stanford University. So please let me welcome Shannon Brownlee.
Thank you, Mary Beth, and thank you all for coming. So I have a confession to make. I'm a reformed hope pusher. Not dope, hope. I want to tell you a little bit about my background. I was a writer at U.S. News and World Report for 10 years. I was their lead medical writer, and I wrote cover stories on all of the great medical breakthroughs that were often coming out of the NIH. And I thought what I was doing was really helping people. I was talking to readers, millions of readers, about all the great developments in biomedical research and all the great developments in medicine. And then I came upon a story that, in effect, radicalized me and began my path to redemption. And the story was about something called the PSA test. Many of the men in this room probably are well aware of the PSA test. It's the prostate-specific antigen test. It's a blood test that's used to screen healthy men for early signs of prostate cancer. And the PSA test now is quite controversial and is, in fact, kind of a poster child for not such a great way to try to help people avoid dying of cancer. But at the time, it was sort of considered the new thing, the great thing that was going to reduce prostate cancer deaths. But I went out and I reported a story that said maybe it's not such a great test. The test, prostate cancer itself comes in many forms, and what the test was very clearly, there was no good evidence that the test was actually reducing the death rate from prostate cancer, but there was abundant evidence that the test was leading a lot of men to get treated unnecessarily for a cancer that probably would never have bothered them. Now, that's probably a radical notion to many people in the room. But this test really there were real problems with the test. And the treatment had a lot of downsides. Incontinence and impotence, more than half of men suffered these two, at least, you know, one or both of these side effects from the treatment. So I wrote this story, and it was a pretty critical story, and my editor said, I don't believe you, in effect. So here's this writer. I've written, you know, all these cover stories. I've won all these awards for my magazine, and I write a story that's critical of something that he thinks is the right thing to do. I've reported it very carefully, and he slashes the story by two-thirds and basically says, I don't think this is right. And that's what made me think, now wait a minute. And over the years, what I started to really, well, it took me a couple of years to quit, but and my son was three, it was time to quit anyway and you know, work from home and be a freelancer, but it took a while for me to start to realize that I was part of a very big machine, an industry, And my job as a reporter at U.S. News and World Report, to some degree, was to act as free advertising for medicine, for healthcare. And that's what I was doing. I was really good at it. And I couldn't do it anymore. I found I couldn't push hope anymore. I needed to push more accurate information, and I found I needed to be more critical of medicine. So those things combined to sort of bring me to the point today where I want to talk to you about unnecessary care. And when I first started my book in 2003, people would say, "What's your book about?" And I said, "Well, it's about unnecessary care." And they looked at me like my hair was on fire. Like, what kind of an idiot are you? We know the problem is people aren't getting enough care. That was the framework in which we thought about healthcare reform pretty exclusively. And I'm very gratified to say that the problem of unnecessary care has really come into its own. It's now considered a part of the problem, and it's now being written about. And as patients and as parents and as children and siblings, you've probably had experiences with it. So I want to talk today about what is to some degree a radical notion in medicine. It's about how we fail to clue patients in to what's really going on. And I want to suggest a new way of being a patient and, in fact, a new way of having an interaction with physicians, a new way for physicians as well. It's a quiet revolution in medicine. And you may not have ever heard of it, but at some point it will be part of your interactions with your physician. It will be a regular part. So, and I hope your doctor is already doing it, but if not, one day your doctor will be doing this quite regularly. So, how many people have had an elective procedure? An elective procedure means that you can, there are multiple ways to treat the condition. So, knee replacement is an elective procedure. Bypass surgery is an elective procedure. A facelift is an elective procedure. It's not necessary, but it's one of multiple ways you can treat something. How many people have had an elective procedure? A lot. So most surgeries are elective procedures. PSA test, mammograms, elective procedures. Angioplasty or a stent to relieve chest pain. That's an elective procedure. So elective procedures account for about 25% of what we spend on healthcare. Only 15% of what we spend is what's called evidence-based medicine, effective care. That means that everyone who has the condition needs to get that particular treatment. You have a heart attack, you need to have aspirin or a beta blocker or both upon discharge. This is sort of the classic one. You go into the hospital, you're elderly, you need a pneumonia vaccine. So only 15% of the money that we spend is on effective care, clearly evidence-based effective care, 25% on these elective procedures. And if you've had an elective procedure, you're supposed to give something called informed consent. It's a legal document. It lays out the risks. Signing it says you understand what the risks are and you still consent. And it's actually supposed to be a conversation between you and the provider, or you and multiple providers, where you really discuss and understand what the potential upside and the potential downside is of the procedure. Now, what's really interesting is in the history of medicine, informed consent is a relatively new idea. If you go back to the time of Hippocrates, he introduced what was then a radical notion, that disease was caused by environmental factors, not divine punishment. So that meant that treatment could be physical rather than spiritual. And today, physicians, of course, take something called the Hippocratic Oath. That the standard way of translating it is primum non nocere, first do no harm. But the actual phrase in Hippocrates' time was physicians must do good and do no harm. So another legacy of Hippocrates was part of medical practice until very recently, don't tell the patient what's going on. And in fact, I remember when my grandfather died of brain cancer, he died never knowing that he had brain cancer. The family and the physician decided that it was best for him not to know. And this was thought of as sort of part of the magic of medicine. And a lot of medicine until very recently was mostly magic. It was the belief in the physician's power. And it was this idea that if you really clued the patient in, it would diminish the physician's power to heal. So physicians had enormous autonomy and authority. It was very paternalistic when you really think about it. They could withhold treatment. They could diagnose and keep that from the patient. And it was reinforced in medieval times by the notion that the doctor's authority was bestowed by God. So we have the Enlightenment, and even that does very little to dislodge this faith in the physician's superior knowledge and his beneficence, this idea that he does things for the benefit of the patient. So physicians have meant well all through history, but until very recently, a visit to the doctor was about as likely to cause you harm as to help you. In fact, I think the turning point came sometime in the 20th century. That the chances that you would be helped by a visit to the physician and by being treated were greater that you would be helped than you would be harmed. And you think about it, the prevailing theory of disease in the medieval time, actually right up until very recently, until the 18th century, the prevailing theory of disease was based on the four humors. And so one of the most prevalent treatments was bleeding. The patient needed to be relieved of all that excess blood, which was causing, the patient was too sanguine. They had too much blood. And if you relieve the blood, you would purge the patient of one of those four humors, and the patient would get better. Now, not until the 20th century and the advent of penicillin did we really see the shift towards chances where you were going to be helped. The 20th century also saw this shift in the relationship between the doctor and the patient and this notion of informed consent, which is a real shift in where the power lies. So this came out of a series of scandals where physicians did things to patients without the patient's knowledge, things that were unethical or harmful. And one of the first cases was brought in 1917 against a New York hospital. A patient had a surgical procedure performed after she had refused the procedure. And Justice Benjamin Cardozo concluded, quote, "Every human being of adult years and sound mind has a right to determine what shall be done to his own body." Think about what that means. Every person of sound mind has a right to decide what will happen to his own body. We kind of take this for granted, but it is a 20th century idea. So things like the Nuremberg trials, the Nazi experiments in the camps, experiments on patients in mental hospitals, on prisoners, all of these things were events that served to strengthen this notion that patients have the right to be informed. So the idea of informed consent has been refined, but the fundamental notion goes back to Cardozo. An adult of sound mind has the right to choose what happens to his or her own body. So today, you will sign an informed consent document if you have an elective procedure. It says you acknowledge you understand why you need the procedure, what the risks are, and that you are consenting to undergo those risks in the hope of benefit. But here's the thing. We know that patients, in many, many cases, don't actually understand the first thing about the procedure. They don't actually understand the first thing about the risks. They don't actually know how small the benefit for many things are. They overestimate benefit a lot. They underestimate risk a lot. They're not very well informed. And this is intelligent, well-educated patients as well as patients who don't speak English very well. I mean, just because you have a lot of education does not necessarily mean that you're going to be well informed about your elective procedure. So we know that patients are consenting something that has been recommended, but the patient hasn't really been engaged in the decision. We delegate a lot of decisions about what's going to happen to us to this person who we know has superior knowledge. Physicians do have superior knowledge, but we also assume is going to make a decision that is in our best interests. So the other thing that we know is that different physicians have different opinions about what the right thing to do for a given patient is. If you have chest pains from angina, some cardiologists will do a really good job of giving you the right medications and really helping you control your chest pain through medication and helping you understand what you need to do. You need to quit smoking, you need to get more exercise, how to take your medications, all of these various things, changing your behavior, taking the drugs, can reduce your chest pain and reduce your risk of having a heart attack or a stroke. But other cardiologists will recommend right off the bat that you undergo an angiogram and that you undergo other procedures, maybe a bypass surgery, maybe a stent, maybe an angioplasty. If you have a hernia, many men in this room probably have suffered from a hernia, and you don't have symptoms, some doctors will recommend that you repair it immediately. And others will say, wait, if it isn't bothering you, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If it isn't bothering you, we won't subject you to surgery. Same condition, same patient, different physicians, different opinions about what the right thing to do is. If you have knee pain for arthritis, some orthopedists will recommend knee replacement right away. Some will say, let's do arthroscopic surgery, which, by the way, has been shown not to be effective. Some will say, let's try losing a little bit of weight, let's try pain medication, and then if we need to, we'll think about knee replacement. So it turns out when it comes to these elective procedures and elective tests like PSA and mammography and knee replacement and angioplasty, who you see is what you get. Because patients often say, what would you do, doctor? What do you recommend, doctor? And they don't really get informed about what their possibilities are, what their alternatives are, and what the trade-offs are in each of those alternatives. So I'll bet more than half of the people in this room, in fact, probably way more than half, are tonsil-free. Has anybody got their tonsils left? No. You lost your tonsils. How many have their tonsils in their throats? Really? That's amazing. That is amazing because tonsillectomy was one of the most common surgical procedures. Common surgical procedures when we were kids. It's very interesting because there was huge variation in what physicians thought about whether or not their young patients needed a tonsillectomy. Some said if you had 3 episodes of a throat infection, that was reason enough to do it. Others thought that the degree of swelling of the tonsils was an indication that it was needed. Others saw no reason to do it at all. And in fact, the evidence for whether or not you ought to get tonsils out was not there. It was non-existent. So it actually depended to a large extent on where you lived. Did everybody grow up in the same town? and I'll give you a very quick example from one of the people that I work with at Dartmouth, a man named Jack Wenberg, who is an incredibly important figure in understanding the sort of variation that we see in how patients are treated in different parts of the country and even within different parts of the state. So he lived in Stowe, Vermont. His kids went to school in Stowe. And a child's chances of having their tonsils out in Stowe was 20% back then. A child's chances of having their tonsils out in Waterbury, Vermont, which was just down the road, Waterville, Vermont, just down the road, was 60%. Now, the kids between Stowe and Waterville did not really differ that much. What differed was the opinions of the physicians in the two different towns. Kind of gives new meaning to the phrase, no child left behind, no tonsil left behind. So we now think, oh, that was then. Now medicine is scientific. Modern medicine is scientific. And today, in fact, tonsillectomy is rarely done. And it's very easy to dismiss this as sort of a practice of a bygone, foolish bygone era. But we are better at diagnosing disease. We have a lot more technology. We have CT scanners. We have all kinds of things. We have ultrasound. We have blood tests for diseases we didn't even know existed 50 years ago. And we like to think that our doctors make decisions for us on the basis of sound evidence. But in fact, if that were so, why do we still see so much variation in how patients are treated in different parts of the country and, in fact, in different parts of California? So I want to I'm just going to hold this up even though you can't really see it very well. And then I'm going to give you some of the statistics from this recent study that was funded by the California Healthcare Foundation. So the studies look like this, and it's on their website. And this is for something called carotid endarterectomy. This is a procedure done on the carotid arteries that supply the brain with blood, and it's supposed to reduce the risk of stroke. The only problem is that carotid endarterectomy also increases your risk of surgical stroke, having a stroke during the surgery. So only certain people are really going to benefit from getting this. So if you live in Santa Maria, which is near Santa Barbara, you're 4 times more likely to undergo a carotid endarterectomy than if you live in Laguna Hills, which is in Orange County. If you live in Clear Lake up in Napa, you're 3 times as likely to undergo a carotid endarterectomy than if you live in Chino. And if you live in Modesto, you're 2.5 times as likely as if you live in Los Angeles. Now, is that because patients need carotid endarterectomy so much more often in Clear Lake, and in Santa Maria and in Modesto, there's no evidence for that. Another example, I'll give you one from here, from Berkeley. So women who live in Berkeley are, oh dear, am I going to find the exact one? Here we go. 10 times more likely to have a vaginal birth after cesarean section. 10 times more likely than women who live in Hanford near Fresno. Now, is that because there's something fundamentally different about women in Berkeley? No, probably not. Probably not. So any elective procedure that I can name, heart procedures, elective stents and angioplasty, once again, Clear Lake is 10 times as likely. If you live in Clear Lake, you're 10 times as likely than if you live in Sonoma. If you live in Fresno, you're 9 times as likely to have angiography. And this is not being driven by differences among patients. It's being driven by the fact that physicians in different parts of California have different practice patterns. So what does this mean for you as patients? How am I doing on time? Good. So what does this mean for you as patients? It means that for some procedures, a very low rate in a region might mean you're not getting care that could help you. It might mean that. So if you live in Los Angeles, the rate of knee replacement, by the way, rate meaning how many knee replacements per the total population in the area. So the rate of knee replacement in Los Angeles, even though there's tons of orthopedic surgeons in Los Angeles, the rate of knee replacement is remarkably low. So it's possible that there are people in Los Angeles who could actually benefit from knee replacement and would want it if they understood that, but they're not getting it. There are also probably people in Los Angeles who are getting knee replacement who really wouldn't have wanted if they'd really understood what their alternatives were. But by the same token, if you live in Lindsay near Bakersfield, chances are that you have a much greater chance of having an angioplasty or a stent than other parts of the state. And that suggests that there are people who are getting these procedures that if they had understood what the risks were and what the benefits were, they would have chosen not to do it. They would have chosen not to do it. In other words, informed consent is broken. They were not well informed. Does anybody remember the story of Redding, California? For those who don't, Redding was a special case. Redding, California has two main hospitals. And at one of those hospitals, there were two physicians who were doing phenomenal numbers of angioplasties and cardiac bypass surgeries. It was the heart procedure hotspot of the country. It was far and away higher than any other place in the country. It was so off the charts that it actually started showing up in the data when you start looking at Medicare data. Most of it was being done at a single hospital at Redding Medical Center, and most of it was being done by these two physicians. One of those physicians, in 27 years at Redding, he catheterized. He did this one procedure on 35,000 patients. That is a huge number. And according to outside experts who looked at the medical records, between a quarter and a half of those patients were inappropriate patients. That means they should not have gotten the procedure. At least 167 of them died from aggressive treatment that they didn't need. Either they were too weak to withstand the surgery and shouldn't have got it, or the physicians were negligent, or they committed errors, or simply that a certain number of people are going to be harmed by these procedures, even if nobody makes a mistake. A certain number of people will be harmed. So today, Redding is no longer a hotspot for cardiac procedures. They've shifted over to carotid and endarterectomy. Now it's another town. It's another two towns in California. It's Clear Lake. Clear Lake is very, very high, and the Bakersfield area is very, very high. And there's a heart hospital in Bakersfield. Well, actually, it's in Lindsay. So this has real consequences for patients, for you as patients. There are about 1 million elective angioplasties and stents done in this country, at least 1 million. 40 minutes to go or 40 seconds? Okay. I need to wrap it up. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I got it. I can do the math here. So I'm not going to talk to you about the number of angioplasties, but I am going to talk to you about a particular patient. I'm going to talk to you about a woman named Marilda. And forgive me, I know there are a couple people in this room who have heard this story before. And Marilda sticks in my mind. I can't get her out of my mind because she's really, it's really quite extraordinary to think about being her. Marilda is 43 years old, and about 3 years ago, she had a whole series of events happening in her life. She's a Brazilian immigrant. She came here to go to college, and instead she got pregnant and had three kids and got married and never went to school. But her oldest son was about to go off to college, her oldest of three, and she was studying to become a nurse's aide, and her husband was beating her. And she was having panic attacks. She was finding herself unable to breathe, feeling like she was having chest pain. And she knew she was having panic attacks, but she was scared. And so she went to the emergency room. And the emergency room checked her out and said, "There's nothing wrong with you," and sent her to her primary care physician. Her primary care physician sent her to a cardiologist. The cardiologist checked her out and says, "There's nothing wrong." She ended up going back to the emergency room again, and she went back to the cardiologist. And the cardiologist said, "Just to be safe, let's do an angiogram. Let's look at your heart." So she went in to have the angiogram, she was semi-awake. She's a little bit drugged, and she could see on the screen that her heart was as clean as a whistle. And the doctor said, "See, you're absolutely fine. Everything's okay." And as he's withdrawing the catheter out of her heart, he perforates her. That means he makes a hole in her coronary artery. And her heart stops. She has to be defibrillated 9 times. For the physicians in the room, they know what that really means. For the non-physicians, think ER with the paddles to get her heart going again, to get it beating in a regular rhythm. 9 times. She said to me that, everybody thinks that when you die, you see a light at the end of the tunnel. She said, "No, when you die, it's really dark. And then when you come back to life, it's really light because there's this light over your head with all the doctors leaning over you." And now she really does have heart disease. She takes 13 different medications, and as you can imagine, one of them is an antidepressant. She can't walk upstairs. She can't walk the dog. She can barely run her life. And whether or not she was an appropriate patient in some ways is not the point. I think she was an inappropriate patient. Physicians who have looked at her records think she was an inappropriate patient. She shouldn't have had it. But let's say she was appropriate. This might have helped her. She had no idea what the possible downsides were. She was not an informed patient. She was a passive patient. She was a scared patient. She, I suspect, is a patient that every physician should dread. Not engaged, passive, not really paying attention, but also she was the kind of patient that none of us want to be because she didn't ask the critical questions and her physician did not really inform her very well. So we don't want to be Marilda. And it may seem like I'm beating up on cardiologists. One of my favorite cardiologists is here in the audience. I'm not, but it's a really convenient one to be able to talk about because there's a lot of stuff going on in cardiology that's not so good. But it turns out that when patients are really informed, they make really different choices. And we know this from trials. We know this from studies. Patients who are really informed tend to be more conservative. They tend, in fact, the evidence suggests that they are 20% less likely to choose an invasive option when they really understand. So how can we make sure that we as patients really understand what the trade-offs are involved in these elective procedures and tests? And how can medicine as a profession make sure that patients are really, really involved and engaged? Well, one way to do that is to give patients access to information that they can understand. And one way to do that is something called a patient decision aid. A patient decision aid is not a person, it's a thing. It's often a brochure, it can be web-based, it may have a video involved, and it helps patients really understand what the trade-offs are. That's the thing that's involved. The process that we need to be asking for, pushing for, requesting is shared decision-making. We need to be asking our physicians to share those decisions rather than delegating the decision to the physician. And this is the revolution in medicine that I'm talking about. One way to think of it is perfected informed consent. If you're a lawyer, Another way to think about it is the democratization of the doctor-patient relationship. And your physician may have access to patient decision aids. If not, you may be able to ask your insurance company for a patient decision aid. And if not, I'm not sure what you're going to do because they're not as available as they should be. But the more we talk to our physicians and say, I want to really understand, and I need the information in a way that I can understand, and your physician is not necessarily very good at conveying that information. Some of your physicians will welcome you asking these kinds of questions, and some will not. But this is what we really need as patients, is we really need to have really good information. And so I want to leave you with this idea that a new way of doing medicine and a new way of being a patient is that we need to ensure that we get all the care that we need and no more. We get the care that we want and no less. And one of the ways to do that is to start thinking about sharing those kinds of crucial decisions. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer questions.
And, of course, our thanks to Shannon Brownlee, Acting Director of the New America Foundation's Health Policy Program. Again, I'm Carolyn Johnson with ABC 7 News. I cover health and science, so this is fascinating for me. I also anchor the 4, 6, and 11 p.m. news. Shannon and I were speaking a little bit earlier. I had a grandmother who was fortunate to live until 105, and she often cited the reason for her longevity to the fact that she was never in the hospital. So for her, it was critical to stay out of the hospital, and she didn't go into one until she was 103 when she'd fallen and hit her head. She was very clear with her advance directive about what she wanted done, and certainly in later years, unfortunately, she was still very lucid, and we had lengthy conversations about how she wanted to die. So what was interesting was, despite this very clear advance directive, despite the fact that I was there to help advocate for her, I had many conversations with physicians about, we don't want an MRI, we don't want invasive tests done. So even when you are clear on what your wishes are, Shannon, how can you convey that? And what needs to shift among the physician population, especially with respect to older adults?
I think your primary care physician is so important in this. Your primary care physician is the person who knows you as a whole person rather than a collection of body parts. Your nephrologist knows your kidneys really well, but your primary care physician should know you. And establishing a relationship where you can really convey those kinds of wishes to that primary care physician, I think, are crucial. Now, primary care has been squeezed terribly. If you've had this experience of sort of being rushed by your doctor, it doesn't feel very good. But primary care is your advocate, should be your advocate, and if your doctor is not your advocate for saying, really, I don't want an MRI because it's not going to make a difference in how I'm treated, then you may need a different doctor.
I think the trick comes when you're in the emergency room.
Yes.
Because while her primary care was on the same page, and so this, again, perhaps speaks to how do we educate physicians.
Her primary care doctor could have been at the emergency room. That's the other thing, is family members need to know that, in fact, being there for your patient in the hospital is part of what primary care is really all about. And a family practice doc is trained to basically say, I need to be there when my patients are in the emergency room.
And can we talk a little bit more about what, in your book, you do discuss sort of end-of-life care and how this can vary between family members who perhaps want one thing and doctors who feel that they must provide, treat.
We have a really inflated view of what medicine can do, particularly when people are old and frail and chronically ill, which is what most of us will be when we die. We'll have one or more chronic illnesses. And the really crucial thing to start making this shift to understanding that medicine can't do everything. And in fact, how you die is incredibly important in how we help our families. And it seems so morbid to talk about death, but it's part of our lives. And we don't prepare for it, we don't want to think about it, and thus I think we push off a lot of those decisions on physicians and nurses, people who really shouldn't be making those decisions, many of them. So a crucial thing is to have those conversations early, to have them with our families. I talk to my dad about dying all the time. He's 81, and I'm the only person in the family who's willing to talk to him about it, and he wants to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of terrific questions here. This one says, given that medicine in this country is driven by reimbursements, how can elective procedures be reduced when physicians often earn more money by ordering them?
You give informed consent. I think this, that one of the solutions, well, there are two solutions. We could simply say patients have to pay out of their own pockets, which I don't think is the right way to do it. I think the first step is to make sure that patients really are informed. And it's going to take a multi-pronged approach. It's going to take patients asking for it. It's going to take patients asking for it. It's going to take family members asking for this ability to share decisions and information. And it's going to take changing the way we reimburse. I think fee-for-service has got to go. For much of medicine, fee-for-service has got to go. And that's, you know, that's kind of saying God is dead.
There's another question that fits with this as well. Please explain, is mammogram an elective procedure?
Yes, a mammogram is an elective procedure. You do not have to have a mammogram. You should be able to choose whether or not you want to have a mammogram, especially in your 40s or 50s when the evidence suggests that there's no benefit to mammograms. Women should be able to choose. Women should be able to choose in their 50s and 60s as well. It is perfectly legitimate to say, I don't want a mammogram. It's perfectly legitimate to say, I do. It depends on which risks you're interested. I personally am afraid of being harmed by medicine. I'm constantly weighing how much I don't want to be harmed by medicine versus how much I don't want to be harmed by disease. And I have to weigh those things. Mammograms are not a slam dunk.
Mm-hmm. And certainly a discussion you should have with your physician about your family history,
yes,
et cetera. This question is about bone marrow transplants for breast cancer. Huge story in the 1990s. This treatment was toxic, expensive, unproven, highly utilized, and ultimately of no benefit. So why haven't we learned from this story?
You know, whoever asked that question, that has bothered me for the last 10 years. I wrote about it, about high-dose chemotherapy for breast cancer and bone marrow transplant for breast cancer in the 90s. And it's really one of the cautionary tales of modern medicine. And physicians don't know the story. Patients don't know the story. It's an extraordinary story to know that medicine, that the belief in this treatment was so strong that patients demanded it, physicians did it without any evidence that it worked, and it killed at least 9,000 women.
Do you believe that drug companies being allowed to advertise on TV, something that occurred really within the last decade or so, has increased the overtreatment of patients?
Oh, yeah. 1997 was the watershed year. There was a Supreme Court case that opened the door to direct-to-consumer advertising. We are one of only two countries that allow it, and it's crazy. It absolutely increases demand for drugs. And physicians, unfortunately, find themselves in the position of having to say no to patients, and they often say yes, even when they shouldn't, because they know the patient will go down the street, because it takes time to explain why you really don't need that Vioxx, and by the way, it increases your risk of a heart attack. I wish there were a way to put that genie back in the bottle. I don't think that there is, given that it's based on a Supreme Court case. And so the solution, I think, is to really start educating yourself and for physicians to be better educated.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, clinical trials and the drug company's involvement in that research and what often happens with those trials?
So who do you think pays for the majority of clinical trials in this country? Clinical trials means human beings are involved in the study. The National Institutes of Health or Big Pharma? Big Pharma, 80%. That means that they control the design of the trial, the data in the trial, the write-up of the trial, and therefore the knowledge about the disease itself and the knowledge about the drug. And this is a crazy way to run medicine. And unfortunately, we're kind of caught. The academic medical centers are dependent on that money right now, and it's going to take a lot of money for the federal government to replace it. So we're not there yet, but we can at least ask for openness, that the data be open, that the people who run the trials not have financial conflicts of interest with the drug companies. There are many things that we can do to sort of mitigate that problem.
And has that been changing? You talk in your book about drug companies providing the free lunch for the doctors, and there's been a move to change that. Are we seeing the changes taking place?
Well, I don't know. I should ask. I ask folks here. How many people see really handsome men and women wheeling little carts into their doctor's office? Those are drug reps. Chosen for their beauty and their persuasiveness. It's starting to change. Some of the academic medical centers are aware of this, but they have not quite been willing to say, look, if you're an academic researcher, you really should not have a financial conflict of interest with the drug industry. And there are a lot of people out there who say, it's sort of, I'm okay, you're not. Remember that book, I'm okay, you're okay? Well, there's this attitude, I'm okay, everybody else is not. I take money from the drug industry, but it doesn't bias me, but I know it biases all those other guys. So it's changing, but it's slow.
Mm-hmm. How do we go about conveying or changing the belief that greater is not better to patients? Because a lot of layman patients, they want the treatment, they want the MRI, they have back pain, they want something
right.
done for it,
right.
and they go to their doctor demanding this. How do we change that?
So part of the problem is the press. I mean, this is why I say I'm a reformed hope pusher. The press never met a breakthrough it didn't like. Never met a new technology it didn't like. This is what sells newspapers and magazines. And it's starting to change. Reporters are getting a little bit more skeptical, but this is happening at a time when they're all being fired. Anybody who has any knowledge is being fired because they're senior, and now everything's being written by 20-year-olds who don't know anything. So sorry, it's true. I was once one of them. And so I think the press has a very important role to play. TV has a
Absolutely.
Very incredibly important mm-hmm. role to play. And so that's a piece of it. Physicians have an important role to play as well. But and part of it goes, once again, it goes back to that primary care physician. One of the reasons that primary care physicians often sort of hand out antibiotics to people who have a viral infection for whom that antibiotic is completely useless and actually breeds resistance in the bugs, is because they're pressed for time. And one of the reasons they're pressed for time is because the reimbursements are so low. We have to find a different way to pay. We have to find a different way to structure primary care. We have to find a different way to educate patients. And part of that is this patient decision aid for elective procedures.
There's another question regarding primary care. You talk about engaged primary care physicians, but medicine is moving to hospitalists. Primary care docs are then often left out of the loop, and that was certainly my experience as well. I was in touch with the primary care doc on the phone, but I'm dealing with a rotating crew of hospitalists.
Right, right. And this is an enormous problem. This is a very sophisticated audience, I must say. It is a huge problem. A lot of primary care docs who are out in private practice are just finally saying no mas and becoming hospitalists because it's steady pay, steady hours, less paperwork. You don't have hardly any paperwork. So we have to get primary care docs back out into community practice. I'm not sure that hospitalists are really benefiting patients as much as they are benefiting hospitals. Hospitals often hire hospitalists to get patients out of beds.
Talk a little bit about some of the changes that you talk about in your book that need to take place.
So one of the things that we know from looking around the country is that there are systems of care that do a better job. They are organized group practices. Kaiser Permanente is the most prominent example in California. And while I'm sure somebody in this audience has some terrible story to tell about Kaiser, because there's always a terrible story to tell about any mm-hmm. healthcare system, when you look at, on average, how patients are treated, you're going to get better care on average at Kaiser than you are in a disorganized system. Another organized system is Mayo Clinic, Group Health of Puget Sound. Every state has at least one, if not multiple, organized group practices. And we know that these group practices are doing a better job. And then what's really interesting, it's not so much that they have better science or more robot surgeries or whatever. What they have is human organization. When you think about healthcare, it is the most complex thing human beings do. It is the most complex industry that we have with the greatest consequences for human lives. You know, everybody talks about how airlines have gotten so much safer. Well, yeah, they have. But, you know, frankly, the problems in airlines are really simple compared to the problems in healthcare. So it's a human organization problem. And so places that have started trying to have some semblance of organization are doing a much better job. We need to pay them in a way that allows them to innovate, to really start learning from their mistakes and learning from their successes, and not punish them financially, which is what happens now when they do innovate, but they lose revenue on a fee-for-service basis.
And also keeping people out of the hospital
The big umbrella idea here is we pour $2.7 trillion. I mean, that is a lot of money. We spend more on healthcare than we spend on defense. Lots more than we spend on the defense industry. So we take $2.7 trillion and we pour it into the acute hospital sector, the acute care hospital sector. And we short the things that actually make people the most healthy, which is food, clean water, good food, exercise, having a good life, not being poor, a whole series of things that have a much greater impact on whether or not we are a healthy population. Now, that's not to say that we want to get rid of hospitals, because hospitals are very important, and people have accidents, and they have heart attacks, and a whole series of things. But we have to find a way to extract some of that money and start devoting it to education, to exercise, to better food, more available food, good food. You in California are kind of spoiled since you have fresh food most places. But even in California, you have food deserts.
Well, it's interesting how you talk about many insurance companies won't cover a nutritionist for diabetes, but they will cover the podiatrist to treat the ulcer wounds.
And they'll pay for the amputation.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. That's a crazy system if what your goal is to be a healthy population.
You also talk about the importance of the electronic medical record and integrating that into this plan.
You know, it's funny. I sort of regret having even written about electronic medical records, because they're now seen as the magic bullet that's going to solve all our problems. Let's have a new technology. The electronic medical records are not going to solve the problem by themselves. And we are racing as fast as we can to implement these things without really thinking about what they really are supposed to do, which is they're supposed to increase the physician's ability to find out what's going on with the patient. They're also supposed to help systems like hospitals actually look at how their physicians are performing and how different physicians are treating patients differently. And I'm not sure that we're going about this in the way that we really need to, but we're sure going to spend a lot of money on it.
Yeah, certain organizations like Kaiser have done this effectively, but
yes,
others are scrambling to get them into
place.
That's
right, and Kaiser does it effectively in part because they're already fairly organized, and so they can then use those medical records to increase their level of organization.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're speaking with Shannon Brownlee, Acting Director of the New America Foundation's Health Policy Program. Ms. Brownlee is discussing unnecessary procedures and overtreatment in the medical profession. We have another question. Do you believe that the Affordable Care Act does enough to curb the overuse of medicine?
No. The Affordable Care Act is kind of a down payment on what we really need to do to really change the way medicine is delivered in this country. It tried to do two things, cover everybody and start to reform the delivery system, and it was a start, it was a beginning, but it really, there's so much more that needs to be done. And we're now at a crisis in this country. We're now at a financial crisis where we cannot keep putting money into Medicare the way that we are. And the problem is that we're now framing the problem in terms of we're going to cut benefits, and that's the way we'll save money. Or we're going to raise the eligibility age to 67, and that's how Medicare is going to save money. Versus, no, we can't touch Medicare. You can't do anything to Medicare. There is a way to save money in Medicare and improve health and improve care. And it isn't by raising the eligibility age to 67. It isn't by cutting physician fees across the board. We have to think much more surgically about what we do about Medicare. So the other argument that's made is, well, if we just have a single-payer system in this country, all our problems will go away. And in fact, Medicare is a single-payer system, and it has all the same problems as the private pay system does. It just pays a little bit less. And it doesn't have quite the same overhead. It doesn't have a profit. Medicare doesn't need to pay dividends to shareholders. So single payer by itself is not going to solve the problem either. We have to find ways to reduce how often patients are hospitalized. We have to find ways how to coordinate care. Does the word coordinate care make people think, what the heck are you talking about, or is that widely understood? Coordinating care is when you have a physician, at least one physician, who really keeps track of everything that's happening to you. And that just doesn't happen. I mean, how many people have had the experience of going to one physician and getting a prescription or getting a test and going to another physician, and it's as if they never talk to each other. They have no idea the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. This is incredibly common, and guess what? It's much less common if you're living someplace like where Kaiser is prominent. It's much less common in a system like Kaiser. So these kinds of problems exacerbate how much we spend, and they also increase the amount of waste in the system, and waste in the system translates to people getting stuff that doesn't help them, getting tests they don't need, getting surgeries they wouldn't want if they understood what the downside was and what the low benefit was, getting that they simply isn't appropriate for them, isn't what they want at that point in their lives. It results in death that is not the way most of us would choose to die, a medicalized death. So one of the things that's very interesting, if you look at variation around California but also around the country, is what happens to people in the last year of life, the last 6 months of life. If you die at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, you will spend 5 times more days in the intensive care unit than if you die at UC San Francisco. And you're still just as sick at San Francisco. But the tendency to treat people very, very intensively at the end of life is much greater in many of these Los Angeles hospitals. So there's enormous variation in how patients are treated, especially in that last year of life. And that has consequences for the quality of their last weeks and months. That has consequences for how much we spend. So having Medicare have a way of changing the way we treat people in more surgical ways is what we have to do, and the Affordable Care Act doesn't quite get there. It's a start.
You've written about the VA hospital as really being a model for how this can be done correctly. Can you describe that in a little bit more detail?
Does anybody think I'm crazy again when I say the VA is a good system? The VA is sort of it's the poster child for what can happen. The VA was the great turnaround story of the 1990s. If you remember the movie Born on the 4th of July with Tom Cruise, where he's so mistreated in the VA, that was pretty accurate. The VA was probably the worst system in the country. And a guy named Ken Kaiser took over the VA. And there were already changes that were happening. And one of the changes that was happening at the VA was a group of physicians and other providers who were known as the hard hats were actually creating a medical record, an electronic medical record. And they were doing it, they were expressly forbidden to do it by the previous administrator of the VA health system. And they did it in the basement of the hospitals. And they wrote programs to create this electronic medical record that helped them start to become organized. And then Ken Kaiser came in, and he recognized the value of this electronic medical record system. And he also recognized the value of primary care. And he got veterans out of the hospital and into primary care systems.
How big is an issue are hospital infections and making those records more public? I know this has been a big push by Consumers Union, so that patients can know which hospitals have the better records. What are your thoughts on that?
I think transparency is incredibly important for healthcare safety and for medical safety. But I'm gonna sort of ask for a show of hands about sort of the order of magnitude of the problem. Mm-hmm. How many people think 20,000 people a year die from hospital-borne infection, an infection that you got while you were in the hospital? How many people think it's around 20,000? How many people think it's around 50,000? How many people think it's around 200,000? Man, this is a tough crowd, smart crowd. It's phenomenal. I mean, when you really think about it, if you look at hospital error, if you look at avoidable error and hospital infection, it's the equivalent of a jumbo jet crashing every single day. That's how many people die. Medicine, when you add up all of the safety problems in medicine, it is the third leading cause of death. That's kind of astonishing mm-hmm. when you think about it. So I think that transparency is a piece of it, but once again, the number of hospital-acquired infections to some degree is a measure of the disorganization of the hospital. The fact that the hospital can't get people to do some of the simple things that are really necessary to reduce infection, like washing your hands.
Yeah, some of the simple things that
right.
can make just enormous differences.
Right.
Here's another question. Should doctors be given broad discretion in how they treat individual patients, or is this very discretion that's causing the problem?
I wonder if there's a sort of a sub-question here, which is should there be mandates for treatment? I'm not sure. But regardless of what the depth of the question, I think there are some things where it's really clear what you're supposed to do. But there aren't that many of those, unfortunately. So much of medicine is a judgment call. What we need is better evidence for what really works and what doesn't. We're starting down that road now with something called the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute to start doing those kinds of scientific studies that we need to do. When it comes to elective procedures, we often don't have any evidence, really, about what works and what doesn't, so patients really need to know that. And when we do have evidence, patients need to know what the evidence says. So I think there it's not a matter of sort of saying the doctor doing the right thing. The right thing is to actually talk to the patient.
We have several questions about over-treatment in the U.S. and how it compares to Canada and Europe. Where do we stand on this?
It's a really interesting question. So the estimate for how much care is delivered in this country that's unnecessary is about 25 to 30%. That's a lot. That's, you know, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of unnecessary care. Is it lower in these single-payer systems like Canada and the U.K.? I don't know. I don't know that anybody knows. We see variation in how patients are cared for in these countries. It may be lower. They have lower rates of things like how many people die in the ICU. So it's not really clear how much lower it really is.
Hmm. We have several questions related to nutrition, supplements, and medical schools. And are doctors being taught the importance of nutrition and supplements to help keep their patients healthier?
They're starting to be. My argument with alternative medicine is that I want it to be subjected to the same kind of rigorous science that regular medicine is, that mainstream medicine needs to be subjected to. If something is harmless, it's probably also not very effective. So go ahead and spend money on it, but it's probably not going to do very much. But I think that there are promising things in the alternative medicine world, and I think there are promising things in the nutritional supplement world, but we need to subject them to really rigorous science.
Do individuals with better or more expensive health care plans tend to get over-treated more than others?
Probably. I don't know that anybody's really looked at it from that perspective.
But certainly if you have a PPO and the ability to go to a specialist, and if,
right.
if you're a patient who's demanding more care, it would seem that you could be headed in that direction.
You know, and here's the thing. It's not as if every doctor or even a majority of doctors are sitting there rubbing their hands together every time a patient mm-hmm. walks in the door. Money is a motivation for all of us, and it's often an unconscious motivation. So I don't think that this is I don't think that doctors are greedier than anybody else. But if a patient is well insured, there is some increased motivation to maybe deliver more care.
And perhaps if that patient is demanding more care.
Yes, absolutely.
This question is, what are the two or three most important things that could be done to reverse the more is better mentality in American medicine?
You know, it's so interesting. As I said, when I started my book, people really did think I was crazy, and now they don't think I'm so crazy. And physicians are really aware of this issue. And it's really a big issue for them to grapple with. Now, there are some physicians who will say, oh, don't be ridiculous. I know exactly what my patients need, and, you know, I'm not over-treating anybody. But I think the majority of physicians are really quite aware that this is a problem, that it's their problem. That it's something that they need to actually acknowledge and do something about. The next question is, what do they do about it? And that's not totally clear at this point. That's still evolving. So I think that patients can have a very, very important role to play. Anytime anybody wants to say, you need to be hospitalized, you need this procedure, you need this drug, whatever it is, it might be a good idea to say, what are the alternatives? And what are the risks and what are the benefits? Really, really work to inform yourselves and really work to have a dialogue.
Another question. Could you talk about women and informed consent, such as DES and the birth control pill?
DES meaning the drug that was given
so
to women.
So going back
for,
many years
right.
when women perhaps took it just as their doctors said, this will help you with morning sickness.
I think that was an example of everybody being in the dark. Everybody being in the dark. One of the things that it suggests is if a drug is new, you don't really want to take it unless you really need to. Vioxx is the perfect example. Everybody remember the example of Vioxx, the painkiller? Vioxx was billed as the great, it was super aspirin. It was going to cure all pain. And it turned out that it increased the risk of heart attack and stroke quite significantly, and it was finally taken off the market. An interesting little story. Kaiser was tracking the science. They have pharmacologists who were tracking the science on Vioxx very carefully, even before it was approved by the FDA. And they said to their physicians, "You know what? We don't think this is such a great drug. It doesn't look like it's any more effective in most people than ibuprofen. It does seem to reduce the risk of a bleed in the stomach or intestines." But be very cautious about prescribing this drug. They probably saved several hundred lives by not being anxious to prescribe that drug. So new drugs are in some ways the most dangerous drugs because they really haven't been tested very well. And you can't really find out what their real side effect profile is going to be until a lot of people take them.
You've talked about the importance of these patient decision aids. Are there websites that you recommend that patients can go to try to educate themselves, or are there certain sites that are helpful? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think every one of the sites has problems. there's something interesting called POEMS, Patient-Oriented Evidence-Based Medicine. But it's by prescription, and physicians can take a look at it, and it's pretty technical. There's another site that's starting up, and it's written for patients. It's called The Number Needed to Treat, the NNT.com. And that has some information that might be helpful to patients, but it's only started, so there's going to be a lot of things that just aren't up there. But many of the sites that we sort of think of as our trusted sites, like WebMD, there's a lot of commercial influence on those sites. So I'm a little bit wary of a lot of the things that are on the web.
And so what can you do as a patient to best protect yourself?
Ask your doctor for a patient decision aid.
Mm-hmm. Back to that. Patient decision aid.
And there aren't that many of those either. But if we start asking our physicians for these things, they're going to say, gee, I guess maybe I should, you know, find out what these things are. And maybe I should get some. And that will start putting pressure on these really balanced aids being created. You need something that's balanced. You want something that is not going to sway you one direction or another, something that's going to be written or talked on a video in a way you can understand so that you can make a choice that is based on your own values.
And we've reached the point in our discussion for the last question. Any changes in your thinking or attitude toward current medical practices and procedures from the time you began your book until now?
Yes, the real change is this acknowledgement and recognition that unnecessary care is an enormous problem in this country. Recognition on the part of patients. Patients live it, and the interest and families live it. And when it happens to you, you think you're an isolated case. But in fact, you're part of a big pattern. And it's also increasingly recognized by the medical community, and I think that's an enormous change, an enormous advance.
Well, our thanks to Shannon Brownlee, Acting Director of the New America Foundation's Health Policy Program. We also thank our audience here and on the radio. This program has been generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. I'm Carolyn Johnson, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.